He let the trainer come and hold the horse while he strapped the saddle on it. She could just hear his laughing voice.
What good would it do to ride a lady's palfrey, which anyone could ride with a bridle of plaited straw? I want you to see. With leathers fitted like this, I can control the fiercest horse you have and make him into a battle steed. Here, this way.
He gave a tug to a buckle somewhere under the horse, then swung himself up one-handed. The horse reared up. Guinevere watched with her mouth open as he leaned into it, forcing the horse down and under control, making it walk sedately. The spirited animal fidgeted, stepping sideways, and Lancelot gestured for one of the king's foot soldiers to give him a long pike.
"Now see!" he shouted. "Supposing that bale of straw there is a Saxon coming at me with one of those great blunt swords of theirs."
And he let the horse go, pounding hard across the paddock. The other horses scattered as he came sweeping down on the straw bale and impaling it on the long pike, then snatching his sword from its scabbard as he whirled, checking the horse in mid-gallop, swinging the sword about him in great circles. Even the king stepped back as he thundered toward them. He brought the animal to a full stop before the king, slid off, and bowed.
"My lord, I ask for leave to train horses and men, so that you may lead them into battle when the Saxons come again, to defeat them as he did at Celloden Wood last summer. We have had victories, but one day there will be a mighty battle which will decide for all time whether Saxon or Roman will rule this land. We're training all the horses we can get, but yours are better than those we can buy or breed."
"I have not sworn allegiance to Arthur," her father said. "Uso was another matter. He was a tried soldier, and Ambrosius's man. Arthur is little more than a boy."
"You still believe that after the battles he has won?" Lancelot asked.
"He has held his throne now for more than a year. He is your High King, sir. Whether you have sworn or not, every battle he fights against the Saxons protects you too. Horses and men. That is little enough to ask."
Leodegrance nodded.
"This is no place to discuss the strategy of a kingdom, Sir Lancelot. I have seen what you can do with the horse. He is yours, my guest."
Lancelot bowed low and thanked King Leodegrance formally. But Guinevere saw his eyes shine like those of a delighted boy. Guinevere wondered how old he was.
"Come within my hall," her father said. "We will drink together, and I will make you an offer."
Guinevere slid down from the wall and ran through the garden to the kitchens, where her father's wife was supervising the baking women.
"Madam, my father will be coming in with the High King's emissary, Lancelot. They will want food and drink."
Eleanor gave her a startled glance.
"Thank you, Guinevere. Go and make yourself tidy, and you may serve the wine. I am far too busy."
Guinevere ran to her room, pulled her best gown on over the simple kirtle she wore, and hung a string of coral beads about her neck. She unbraided her fair hair and let it fall, rippled from the tight braiding. Then she put on the little gold maiden circlet she wore, and went down, composing her steps and moving lightly. She knew the blue gown became her as no other colour, no matter how costly, could do. She fetched a bronze basin, filled it with warmed water from the kettle hanging near the fire, and strewed rose leaves in it. She came into the hall as her father and Lancelot were entering. She set down her basin, took their cloaks and hung them on the peg, then came and offered them the warmed, scented water to wash their hands. Lancelot smiled, and she knew he had recognised her.
"Did we not meet on the Isle of the Priests, lady?" "You have met my daughter, sir."
Lancelot nodded, and Guinevere said in her shyest little voice, she had found long ago that it displeased her father if she spoke out boldly,
"Father, he showed me the way to my convent door when I was lost."
Leodegrance smiled at her indulgently.
My little featherhead. If she goes 3 steps from her own doorway, she's lost. Well, Sir Lancelot, what do you think of my horses?
I've told you, they're better than any we can buy or breed, he said. We have some from the Moorish realms down in Spain, and we have bred them with the Highland ponies. So we have horses that are sturdy and can endure our climate, but are swift and brave. But we need more. We can breed only so many. You have more than enough, and I can show you how to train them, so you can lead them into battle.
No,
the king interrupted.
I'm an old man. I have no desire to learn new battle methods. I have been 4 times married, but all my former wives bore only sickly boys who die before they are weaned, sometimes before they are baptized. I have daughters. When the eldest marries, her husband will lead my men into battle, and can train them as he will. Tell your High King to come here, and we will discuss the matter.
Lancelot said, a little stiffly, I am my Lord Arthur's cousin and his captain, sire. But even I don't tell him to come and go.
Beseech him, then, to come to an old man who doesn't want to ride out from his own fireside,
the king said, a little wryly.
If he will not come for me, perhaps he will come to know how I will dispose of my horses and the armed men to ride them.
Lancelot bowed.
No doubt he will. Enough of this, then. Pour us some wine, daughter, the king said.
And Guinevere came shyly and poured wine into their cups.
Now run along, my girl, so that my guest and I may talk together.
Guinevere, dismissed, waited in the garden until a servant came out and called for the Lord Lancelot's horse and armour. The horse he had ridden here and the horse her father had given him were brought to the door, and she watched from the shadow of the wall until she saw him ride away. Then she stepped out and stood waiting. Her heart pounded. Would he think her too bold? But he saw her and smiled, and the smile seized her very heart. Are you not afraid of that great fierce horse?
Lancelot shook his head. My lady, I don't believe the horse was ever foaled that I can't ride.
She said, almost whispering, Is it true that you control horses with your magic? He threw back his head with a ringing laugh.
By no means, lady. I have no magic. I like horses, and I understand their ways, and the way their minds work, that's all. Do I look to you like a sorcerer?
But they say you have fairy blood, she said,
and his laughter grew grave. He said, My mother was indeed one of the old race who ruled this land before the Roman people ever came here, or even the northern tribesmen. She is priestess on the Isle of Avalon, and a very wise woman.
I can see that you wouldn't want to speak ill of your mother, Guinevere said. But the sisters on Ynys Wytryn said that the women of Avalon were evil witches and served the devils. He shook his head, still grave.
Not so, he said. I don't know my mother well. I was fostered elsewhere. I fear her as much as I love. But I can tell you she's no evil woman. She brought my Lord Arthur to the throne and gave him his sword to stand against the Saxons. Does that sound so evil to you? As for her magic, it's only the ignorant among them who say she is a sorceress. I think it well that a woman should be wise.
Guinevere hung her head. I'm not wise. I'm very stupid. Even among the sisters, I learned only enough to read my way through the mass book, which they said was all I needed of learning. And then such things as women learn, cookery and herbs and simples and the binding of wounds.
For me, all that would be a greater mystery than the training of horses, which you think magic,
Lancelot said with his wide smile. Then he leaned down from his horse and touched her cheek.
If God is good, and the Saxons hold off a few moons yet, I will see you again when I come here in the High King's train. Say a prayer for me, lady."
He rode away, and Guinevere stood watching, her heart pounding. But this time the sensation was almost pleasant. He would come again. He wanted to come again. And her father had said she should be married to someone who could lead horses and men into battle. Who better than the High King's cousin and his captain of horse? Was he thinking then to marry her to Lancelot? She felt herself blush with delight and happiness. For the first time she felt pretty and bold and brave. But inside the hall her father said,
"A handsome man, this elf Arrow, and good with horses, but far too handsome to be reckoned more than that."
Guinevere said, surprised at her own boldness, "If the High King has made him his first of captains, he must be the best of fighters." Leodegrance shrugged.
"The king's cousin, he could hardly be left without some post in his armies. Has he tried to win your heart?"
Or, he added with the scowl that frightened her,
"your maidenhead?"
She felt herself blushing again and was hopelessly angry at herself. "No. He is an honourable man, and what he has said to me is no more than he could have said in your presence, father."
"Well, don't get any ideas into that featherhead of yours,"
Leodegrance said gruffly.
"You can look higher than that one. He's no more than one of King Ban's bastards by God knows who, some damsel of Avalon."
"His mother is the Lady of Avalon, the great high priestess of the old people, and he is himself a king's son."
"Ban of Benwick? Ban has half a dozen legitimate sons," said her father. "Why marry a king's captain? If all goes as I plan, you'll wed the High King himself."
Guinevere shrank away, saying, "I'd be afraid to be the High Queen."
"You're afraid of everything anyway,"
her father said brutally.
"That's why you need a man to take care of you, and better the king than the king's captain."
He saw her mouth trembling and said, genial again,
"There, there, my girl, don't cry. You must trust me to know what's best for you. That's what I'm here for, to look after you, and make a good marriage with a trusty man to look after my pretty little featherhead."
If he had raged at her, Guinevere could have held on to her rebellion. "But how," she thought wildly, "can I complain of the best of fathers who has only my own welfare at heart?" Chapter 3 On a day in early spring, in the year following Arthur's crowning, the Lady Igraine sat in her cloister, bent over a set of embroidered altar linens. All her life she had loved this fine work, but as a young girl, and later married to Gaulois, she had been kept busy, like all women, with the weaving and spinning and sewing of clothes for her household. As Uther's queen, with a household of servants, she had been able to spend her time on fine broideries and weaving of borders and ribbons in silk, and here, in the nunnery, she put her skill to good use. Otherwise, she thought a little ruefully, it would be for her as it was with so many of the nuns, the weaving only of the dark, plain woollen dresses which all of them, including Igraine herself, wore, or the smooth but boring white linens for veils and coifs and altar cloths. Only two or three of the sisters could weave with silks or do fine embroidering, and of them Igraine was the cleverest. She was a little troubled. Again, as she sat down at her frame this morning, she thought she heard the cry, and jerked around before she could stop herself. It seemed to her that somewhere Morgaine cried out, "Mother!" And the cry was one of agony and despair. But the cloister was quiet and empty around her, and after a moment Igraine made the sign of the cross and sat down again to her work.
Still?
Resolutely, she banished the temptation. Long ago she had renounced the sight as the work of the fiend. With sorcery she would have no doings. She didn't believe Vivian was evil in herself, but the old gods of Avalon were certainly allied to the devil, or they could not maintain their force in a Christian land. And she had given her daughter to those old gods. Late last summer, Vivian had sent her a message saying, "If Morgaine is with you, tell her that all is well." Troubled, Igraine had sent a reply that she hadn't seen Morgaine since Arthur's crowning. She had thought her still safe at Avalon. The Mother Superior of the convent had been dismayed at the thought of a messenger from Avalon to one of her ladies. Even when Igraine explained that it was a message from her sister, the lady had still been displeased, and said firmly that there could be no coming and going, even of messages, with that ungodly place. Igraine, then, had been deeply troubled. If Morgaine had left Avalon, she must have quarrelled with Vivian. It was unheard of for a sworn priestess of the highest rank to leave the island except upon the business of Avalon. For Morgaine to leave without the knowledge or permission of the lady was so unprecedented that it made her blood run cold. Where could she have gone? Had she run away with some paramour? Or was she living a lawless life without the rights either of Avalon or the church? Had she gone to Morgore's? Was she lying somewhere dead? Nevertheless, although she prayed continually for her daughter, Igraine had resolutely refused the constant temptation to use the sight. Still, much of this winter, it seemed that Morgaine had walked at her side, not the pale, sombre priestess she had seen at the crowning, but the little girl who had been the only comfort those desperate, lonely years in Cornwall, of the frightened child-wife, child-mother she had been. Little Morgaine, in a saffron gown and ribbons, a solemn child, dark-eyed in her crimson cloak. Morgaine with her little brother in her arms. Her two children sleeping, dark-haired and golden, close together on the one pillow. How often, she wondered, had she neglected Morgaine after she had come to her beloved Uther and had borne him a son and heir to his kingdom? Morgaine hadn't been happy at Uther's court, nor had she ever had much love for Uther. And it was for that reason, as much as from Vivian's entreaty, that she had let Morgaine go to be fostered at Avalon. Only now she felt guilty. Had she not been over quick to send her daughter away, so that she might give all her thought to Uther and his children? Against her will, an old saying of Avalon rang in Igraine's mind. The goddess does not shower her gifts on those who reject them. In sending her own children away, one to fosterage, for his own safety, she reminded herself, remembering Arthur lying white as death after the fall from the stallion, and the other to Avalon, in sending them away, had she herself sown the seed of loss? Was the goddess unwilling to give her another child when she had let the first go so willingly? She had discussed this with her confessor more than once, and he had reassured her that it was just as well to send Arthur away. Every boy must go for fostering sooner or later. But, he said, she should not have sent Morgaine to Avalon. If the child was unhappy in Uther's court, she should have been sent to school in a nunnery somewhere. She had thought, after hearing that Morgaine wasn't in Avalon, of sending a messenger to King Lot's court to find out if she was there. But then the winter settled in earnest, and every day was a new battle against cold, chilblains, the vicious dampness everywhere. Even the sisters went hungry in the depths of winter, sharing what food they had with beggars and peasants. And once, in the hard weeks of winter, she thought she heard Morgaine's voice crying out for her in anguish. Mother, mother,
Morgaine alone and terrified. Morgaine dying. Where? Oh, God, where? Her fingers clenched the cross, which, like all the sisters of the convent, she wore at her belt. Lord Jesus, keep and guard her. Mary, Mother Divine, even if she is a sinner and a sorceress. Pity her, Jesus, as you pitied the Dame of Magdala, who was worse than she. In dismay, she realized that a tear had dripped down on the fine work she was doing. It might spot the work. She wiped her eyes with her linen veil and held the embroidery frame further away, narrowing her eyes to see better. Oh, she was getting old. Her sight blurred a little from time to time. Or was it tears that blurred her vision? She bent resolutely over her embroidery again, but Morgaine's face seemed again to be before her, and she could hear in her imagination that despairing shriek, as if Morgaine's soul were being torn from her body. She herself had cried out like that, for the mother she could hardly remember, when Morgaine was born. Did all women in childbirth cry out for their mothers? Terror gripped her. Morgaine, in that desperate winter, giving birth somewhere. Morgause had made some such jest at Arthur's crowning, saying Morgaine was as squeamish with her food as a breeding woman. Against her will, Igraine found herself counting on her fingers. Yes, if it had been so with her, Morgaine would have borne her child in the dead of winter. And now, even in that soft spring, she seemed to hear again that cry. She longed to go to her daughter. But where? Where? There was a step behind her, and a tentative cough, and one of the young girls fostered in the nunnery said, "Lady, there are visitors for you in the outer room. One of them is a churchman, the archbishop himself." Igraine put her embroidery aside. After all, it wasn't spotted. All the tears women shed, they leave no mark on the world, she thought in bitterness. Why does the archbishop of all men living wish to see me?
He didn't tell me, lady. And I don't think he told the Mother Superior either, said the little girl, not at all unwilling to gossip for a minute. But didn't you send gifts to the church there at the time of the High King's crowning?
Igraine had, but she didn't think the archbishop would have come here to speak of a past charity. Perhaps he wanted something more. Priests were seldom greedy for themselves, but all priests, especially those from rich churches, were greedy for silver and gold for their altars. "Who are the others?" she asked, knowing that the young girl was eager to talk.
"Lady, I don't know. But I do know that the Mother Superior wanted to forbid one of them because..." Her eyes grew wide. "He's a wizard and sorcerer," so she said, "and a druid."
Igraine rose. "It is the Merlin of Britain, for he is my father, and he is no wizard child, but a scholar trained in the crafts of the wise. Even the church fathers say that the druids are good and noble men, and worship with them in harmony, since they acknowledge God in all things, and Christ as one of many prophets of God." The little girl dropped a small curtsy, acknowledging correction, as Igraine put away the embroidery work and adjusted her veil smoothly around her face. When she came into the outer room, she saw not only the Merlin and a strange, austere man in the dark dress, which churchmen were beginning to adopt to set them off from seculars, but a third man she hardly recognised, even when he turned. For a moment, it was as if she looked into Uther's face.
"Gwydion," she exclaimed, then quickly amending.
"Arthur, forgive me, I forgot." She would have knelt before the High King, but he reached out quickly and prevented her. "Mother, never kneel in my presence. I forbid it. Igraine bowed to the Merlin, and to the dour, austere-looking archbishop.
"This is my mother, Uther's queen," Arthur said, and the archbishop responded, stretching his lips in what Igraine supposed was meant for a smile. "But now she has a higher honour than royalty, in that she is a bride of Christ."
"Hardly a bride," Igraine thought. "Simply a widow who has taken refuge in his house." But she didn't say so, and bowed her head.
Arthur said, "Lady, this is Patricius, Archbishop of the Isle of Priests, now called Glastonbury, who has newly come there."
"Aye, by God's will," the Archbishop said. "Having lately driven out all the evil magicians from Ireland, I am come to drive them forth from all Christian lands. I found in Glastonbury a corrupt lot of priests, tolerating among them even the common worship which the Druids, at which our Lord who died for us, would have wept tears of blood."
Taliesin the Merlin said in his soft voice,
"Why, then, you would be harsher than Christ himself, brother. For he, I seem to remember, was greatly chided that he consorted with outcasts and sinners, and even tax-collectors, and such ladies as the Magdalene, when they would have had him a Nazarite like to John the Baptizer. And at last, even when he hung dying on his cross, he did promise the thief that that same night he would join him in paradise.
No?
I think too many people presume to read the divine scriptures and fall into just such errors as this," said Patricia sternly. "Those who presume on their learning will learn, I trust, to listen to their priests for the true interpretations."
The Merlin smiled gently.
"I cannot join you in that wish, brother. I am dedicated to the belief that it is God's will that all men should strive for wisdom in themselves, not look to it from some other. Babes, perhaps, must have their food chewed for them by a nurse, but men may drink and eat of wisdom for themselves."
"Come, come," Arthur interrupted with a smile. "I'll have no controversies between my two dearest counsellors. Lord Merlin's wisdom is indispensable to me. He set me on my throne."
"Sir," said the Archbishop, "God set you there."
"With the help of the Merlin," said Arthur, "and I pledged to him I would listen to his counsel always. Would you have me forsworn, Father Patricius?"
He spoke the name with the North Country accent of the lands where he had been fostered.
"Come, Mother, sit down, and let's talk.
First, let me send for wine to refresh you after your long ride here."
"Thank you, Mother, and if you will, send some too to Kai and Gawain, who rode hither with me. They wouldn't have me come unguarded. They insist on doing for me the service of chamberlains and grooms, as if I couldn't lift a hand for myself. I can do for myself as well as any soldier, with only the help of an ordinary groom or two, but they won't have it."
"Your companion shall have the best," Igraine said, and went to give orders for food and wine to be served the strangers and all their retinue. Wine was brought for the guests, and Igraine poured it. "How is it with you, my son?" Looking him over, he seemed 10 years older than the slightly built boy who had been crowned last summer. He had grown, it seemed, half a handspan, and his shoulders were broader. There was a red seam on his face. It was already drawing cleanly together. God be praised!
"Well, no soldier could escape a wound or two. As you see, Mother, I've been fighting, but God has spared me," he said. "And now I come here on a peaceful mission. But how is it with you here?"
She smiled.
"Oh, nothing happens here," she said. "But I had word from Avalon that Morgaine had left the island. Is she at your court?"
He shook his head.
"Why, no, Mother. I've hardly a court worth the name," he said. "Kai keeps my castle. I had to force it on him. He'd rather ride with me to war. but I bade him stay and keep my house secure. And two or three of father's old knights, too old to ride, are there with their wives and youngest sons. Morgaine's at the court of Lot. Gawain told me as much when his brother came south to fight in my armies. Young Agravaine. He said Morgaine had come to attend on his mother. He'd only seen her a time or two, but she was well, and seemed in good spirits. She plays on the harp for Morgawse, and keeps the keys of her spice cupboard. I gather Agravaine was quite charmed with her.
A look of pain passed over his face, and Igraine wondered at it, but said nothing.
God be thanked that Morgaine is safe among kindred. I had been frightened for her.
This was not the time, certainly not with churchmen present, to inquire whether Morgaine had borne a child.
When did Agravaine come south?
It was early in the fall, was it not, Lord Merlin? I believe it was.
Then Agravaine would have known nothing. She herself had seen Morgaine and never guessed.
If indeed it had been so with Morgaine, and not a fantasy born of her own imaginings. Well, mother, I came to speak of women's affairs at that. It seems I should be married. I have no heir but Gawain.
I like not that, Igraine said.
Lot has been waiting for that all these many years.
Don't trust his son behind you.
Arthur's eyes blazed with anger.
Even you shall not speak so of my cousin Gawain, mother.
He is my sworn companion.
And I love him as the brother I never had, even as I love Lancelot. If Gawain wished for my throne, he need only have relaxed his vigilance for 5 minutes, and I would have a split neck, not this slash on my face, and Gawain would be High King. I would trust him with my life and honour.
Igraine was amazed at his vehemence. Then I am glad you have so loyal and trusty a follower, my son. She added with a caustic smile, "That must be a grief indeed to Lot, that his sons love you so well."
"I know not what I have done that they should wish me so well, but they do, for which I consider myself blessed." "Aye," Taliesin said, "Gawain will be staunch and loyal to death, Arthur, and beyond, if God wills."
The Archbishop said austerely,
"Man cannot presume to know God's will."
Taliesin ignored him and said,
"More trusty even than Lancelot, Arthur, though it grieves me to say so."
Arthur smiled, and Igraine thought, with a pang at heart, "He has all of Uther's charm. He too can inspire great loyalty in his followers. How like his father he is."
Arthur said, "Come, I will chide even you, Lord Merlin, if you speak so of my dearest friend. Lancelot, too, I would trust with my life and my honour."
Merlin said with a sigh,
"Oh, yes, with your life you may trust him, I'm sure. I'm not sure he will not break in the final test, but certainly he loves you well and would guard your life beyond his own."
Patricius said,
"Certainly Gawain is a good Christian, but I'm not so sure about Lancelot. A time will come, I trust, when all these folk who call themselves Christian and are not may be revealed as the demon worshippers they are in truth. Whosoever will not accept the authority of Holy Church about the will of God are even as Christ says, 'Ye who are not for me are against me.' Yet all over Britain there are those who are little better than pagans. In Tara I dealt with these, when I lighted the paschal fires for Easter on one of their unholy hills, and the king's druids couldn't stand against me. Yet even in the hallowed Isle of Glastonbury, where the sainted Joseph of Arimathea walked, I find the very priests worshipping a sacred well. This is heathendom. I will close it if I must appeal to the Bishop of Rome himself."
Arthur smiled and said,
I cannot imagine that the Bishop of Rome would have the slightest idea what is going on in Britain.
Taliesin said gently, Father Patricius, you would do a great disservice to the people of this land if you close their sacred well. It is a gift from God.
It is a part of pagan worship.
The eyes of the Archbishop glowed with the austere fire of the fanatic.
It comes from God, the old Druid insisted, because there is nothing in this universe which doesn't come from God, and simple people need simple signs and symbols. If they worship God in the waters which flow from his bounty, how is that evil?
God cannot be worshipped in symbols which are made by man.
There you are in total agreement with me, my brother, said the Merlin. For a part of the Druid wisdom lies in the saying that God, who is beyond all, cannot be worshipped in any dwelling made by human hands, but only under his own sky.
And yet you build churches and deck them richly with gold and silver. Wherefore, then, is the evil in drinking from the sacred springs which God has made and blessed with vision and healing?
The devil gives you your knowledge of such things, Patricius said sternly.
And Taliesin laughed.
Ah, but God makes doubts, and the devil too, and in the end of time they will all come to him and obey his will.
Arthur interrupted before Patricius could answer.
Good fathers, we came not here to argue theology.
True, said Igraine, relieved. We were speaking of Gawain and Morgause's other son, Agravain, is it? And of your marriage.
Pity, Arthur said, that since Lot's sons love me well, and Lot, I doubt it not, is eager to have his household heir with me to the high kingship, that Morgause hasn't a daughter, so that I could be his son-in-law, and he would know that his daughter's son was my heir.
That would suit well, Taliesin said,
for you are both of the royal line of Avalon.
Patricius frowned.
Is not Morgause your mother's sister, my lord Arthur? To wed with her daughter would be little better than bedding your own sister.
Arthur looked troubled. Igraine said, I agree. Even if Morgause had a daughter, it isn't even to be thought of. Arthur said plaintively,
I should find it easy to be fond of a sister of Gawain. The idea of marrying a stranger doesn't please me all that much, and I wouldn't think the girl would be pleased either.
It happens to every woman,
Igraine said, and was surprised to hear herself. Was she still bitter over what was so long past?
Marriages must be arranged by those with wiser heads than any young maiden could have.
Arthur sighed. He said,
King Leodegrance has offered me his daughter. I forget her name. And has offered, too, that her dowry shall be 100 of his best men, all armed. And hear this, mother, each with the good horses he breeds, so that Lancelot may train them. This was one of the secrets of the Caesars, that their best cohorts fought on horseback. Before them, none but the Scythians ever used horses, except to move supplies and sometimes for riders to send messages.
If I had 400 men who could fight as cavalry. Well, mother, I could drive the Saxons back to their shores yelping like their own hounds.
Igraine laughed. That hardly seems reason to marry, my son. Horses can be bought, and men hired.
But, Arthur said, Leodegrance is of no mind to sell. I think he has it in his mind that in return for this dowry, and it is a kingly dowry, doubt not, he would like it well to be bound by kinship's ties to the High King. Not that he is the only one, but he has offered more than any other will offer. What I wish to ask you, mother, I'm unwilling to send any ordinary messenger to tell the king that I'll take his daughter,
and he should bundle her up like a package and send her to my court. Would you go and give my answer to the king and escort her to my court?"
Igraine started to nod her agreement, then remembered that she had taken vows in this place. "Can you not send one of your trusty men, Gawain or Lancelot?"
"Gawain is a wencher. I'm not so sure I want him within reach of my bride," Arthur said, laughing. "Let it be Lancelot."
The Merlin said somberly,
"Igraine, I feel you should go."
"Why, grandfather," Arthur said,
"has Lancelot such charms that you fear my bride will love him instead?"
Taliesin sighed. Igraine said quickly, "I will go, if the abbess of this place gives me leave." The mother superior, she thought, couldn't refuse her leave to attend her son's wedding. And she realized that after years of being a queen, it wasn't easy to sit quietly behind walls and await tidings of the great events moving in the land. That was, perhaps, every woman's lot, but she would avoid it as long as she could.
Chapter 4. Guinevere felt the familiar nausea gripping the pit of her stomach. She began to wonder if before they set forth she would have to run at once to the privy. What would she do if the need came on her after she had mounted and ridden out? She looked at Igraine, who stood tall and composed, rather like the Mother Superior of her old convent. Igraine had seemed kind and motherly on that first visit a year ago, when the marriage had been arranged. Now, come to escort Guinevere to her bridal, she seemed stern and demanding, with no trace of the terror that gripped at Guinevere. How could she be so calm? Guinevere ventured, in a small voice, peering at the waiting horses and litter, "Aren't you afraid? It's so far."
"Afraid? Why, no," said Igraine. "I have been to Carleon many times, and it's not likely the Saxons are on the road to war this time. Travelling in winter is troublesome, with mud and rain, but better that than fall into the hands of the barbarians."
Guinevere felt the shock and shame gripping her, and clenched her fists, looking down at her sturdy, ugly travelling shoes. Igraine reached out and took her hand, smoothing the small fingers.
"I had forgotten. You've never been from home before, except to and from your convent. You were in Glastonbury, were you not?"
Guinevere nodded. "I wish I were going back there." She felt Igraine's sharp eyes on her for a moment, and quailed. Perhaps the lady would know she was unhappy at marrying her son, and come to dislike her. But Igraine only said, holding her hand firmly, "I wasn't happy when I went first to be wedded to the Duke of Cornwall. I wasn't happy until I held my daughter in my arms. But I had scarce completed my 15th year. You are almost 18, are you not?" Clinging to Igraine's hand, Guinevere felt a little less panic. But even so, as she stepped outside the gate, it seemed that the sky overhead was a vast menace, threatening, low, filled with rain clouds. The path before the house was a sea of mud where the horses had been trampling. Now they were being drawn up into riding order with more men, it seemed to Guinevere, than she had ever seen together in her life, shouting and calling to each other, the horses neighing, and the yard full of confusion. But Igraine held her hand tightly, and Guinevere, shrinking, followed her. "I'm grateful that you come to escort me, lady."
Igraine smiled. "I am all too worldly. I like a chance to travel beyond convent walls."
She made a long step to avoid a pile of horse dung which steamed in the mud.
"Mind your step there, child. Look, your father has set aside these two fine ponies for us. Do you like riding?"
Guinevere shook her head and whispered, "I thought I could ride in a litter."
"Why, so you can, if you wish,"
Igraine said, looking at her wonderingly.
"But you will grow very weary of it, I should think."
"When my sister Vivian went on her travels, she used to wear men's breeches. I should have found you a pair, though at my age it would hardly be seemly." Guinevere blushed scarlet.
"I couldn't," she said, shaking. "It's forbidden for a woman to put on the clothes of a man, so it says in Holy Writ."
Igraine chuckled.
"The apostle seemed to know little of the North Country. It's hot where he lived," she said. "And I've heard that the men in that country where our Lord lived knew nothing of breeches, but wore long gowns as some Roman men did, and do still. I think it meant only that women were not to wear the garb of some particular man. Not that they weren't to wear clothing fashioned in a man's style. And certainly my sister Vivian is the most modest of women. She is a priestess of Avalon."
Guinevere's eyes were wide.
"Is she a witch, madam?"
"No, no. She is a wise woman, learned in herbs and medicines, and having the sight. But she has sworn a vow never to hurt man nor beast. She doesn't even eat flesh food," Igraine said. "She lives as austerely as any abbess."
"Look," she said, and pointed.
"There's Lancelot, Arthur's chief companion. He has come to escort us, and to bring back the horses and men."
Guinevere smiled, feeling a blush spread to her cheeks. She said,
"I know Lancelot. He came to show my father what he could do with the horses."
Igraine said,
"Aye, he rides like one of those centaurs the ancients used to speak of, half horse and half man."
Lancelot swung down from his horse. His cheeks were as crimson with the cold as the Roman cloak he wore. The collar was turned high around his face. He bowed to the ladies.
"Madam," he said to Igraine, "are you ready to ride?"
"I think so."
"The princess's luggage is already loaded on that cart, I think," Igraine said, looking at the bulky wagon loaded high and covered with skins. "A bed frame and furnishings, a great carved chest, a large and a small loom, pots and kettles."
"Aye, I hope it doesn't get mired in all this mud," Lancelot said, looking at the yoke of oxen hauling it.
"It's not that wagon I'm worried about, but the other. The king's wedding gift to Arthur," he added, without enthusiasm, looking at the second, much larger cart. "I would have thought it better to have a table built for the king's house in Carleon, if Uther hadn't left tables and furniture enough. Not that I begrudge my lady her bride furniture," he added with a quick smile at Guinevere that made her cheeks glow. "But a table! As if my Lord Arthur hadn't enough furniture for his hall."
"Ah, but that table is one of my father's treasures," said Guinevere. "It was a prize of war from one of the kings of Tara, where my grandsire fought him and carried off his best mead hall table. It is round, you see, so a bard can sit at the centre to sing to them, or the servants pass round to pour wine or beer. And when he entertained his fellow kings, he need not set one higher than another. So my father thought it fitting for a high king, who must also seat his well-born companions without preferring one above the other."
"It's truly a king's gift," Lancelot said politely. "But it takes three yoke of oxen to haul it, lady, and God alone knows how many joiners and carpenters to put it together again when we have come there. So that instead of travelling at the pace of a company of horse, we must plod along at the pace of the slowest ox." "Oh, well, the wedding cannot begin until you get there, my lady."
He cocked up his head, listened, and shouted,
"I'll come in a minute, man. I can't be everywhere at once."
He bowed.
"Ladies, I must get this army moving. Can I help you to your horses?"
"I think Guinevere wants to travel in the litter," said Igraine.
Lancelot said with a smile, "Why, it is as if the sun went behind a cloud then. But you do as you will, lady. I hope you will shine out on us again another day, perhaps.
Guinevere felt pleasantly embarrassed, as she always did when Lancelot made his pretty speeches. She never knew whether he was serious or whether he was teasing her. Suddenly, as he rode away, she felt afraid again. The horses towering around her, the hordes of men coming and going. It was as if they really were the army Lancelot had called them, and she no more than an unregarded piece of luggage, almost a prize of war. Silent, she let Igraine help her into the litter, which was covered with cushions and a fur rug, and she curled up in a corner of it. "Shall I leave the curtains of the litter open so we can have some light and air?" Igraine asked, settling herself comfortably in the cushions. "No," said Guinevere in a choking voice. I feel better with them closed." With a shrug, Igraine closed the curtains. She looked out through a crack, watching the first of the horsemen ride out, the wagons swing into line. A kingly dowry indeed, all these men, armed horsemen with weapons and gear to be added to Arthur's armies. It was almost like what she had heard of a Roman legion. Guinevere's head was on the pillows, her face white, her eyes shut. "Are you sick?" Igraine asked in wonder. Guinevere shook her head. "It's just so big," she said. "I'm afraid," she whispered. "Afraid? But my dear child!" Igraine broke off, and after a moment said, "Well, you'll feel better soon." Guinevere, her arms crossed over her eyes, hardly knew it when the litter began moving. She had willed herself into a state of half-sleep in which she could hold the panic at bay. Where was she going under that huge all-covering sky, over the wide moors and through so many hills? The knot of panic in her belly pulled tighter and tighter. All round her she heard the sounds of horses and men, an army on the march. She was merely part of the furniture of the horses and men and their gear and a mead table. She was only a bride, with all that properly belonged to her, clothes and gowns and jewels and a loom and a kettle and some combs and hackles for spinning flax. She was not herself. There was nothing for herself. She was only some property of a high king who hadn't even bothered to come and see the woman they were sending, along with all the horses and gear. She was another mare, a brood mare this time for the High King's stud service, hopefully to provide a royal son. Guinevere thought she would smother with the rage that was choking her. But no, she mustn't be angry. It wasn't seemly to be angry. The Mother Superior had told her in the convent that it was a woman's proper business to be married and bear children. She had wanted to be a nun and stay in the convent, and learn to read and make beautiful letters with her clever pen and brush. But that wasn't suitable for a princess. She must obey her father's will as if it were the will of God. Women had to be especially careful to do the will of God, because it was through a woman that mankind had fallen into original sin, and every woman must be aware that it was her work to atone for that original sin in Eden. No woman could ever be really good except for Mary, the mother of Christ. All other women were evil. They never had any chance to be anything but evil. This was her punishment for being like Eve, sinful, filled with rage and rebellion against the will of God. She whispered a prayer and willed herself into semi-consciousness again. Igraine, resigning herself to riding behind closed curtains, although craving fresh air, wondered what in the world was wrong with the girl. She hadn't said a word against the marriage. Well, she, Igraine, hadn't rebelled against her marriage to Gaulois, either. Remembering the angry and terrified child she had been, she sympathised with Guinevere. But why should the girl huddle behind curtains instead of going with her head up to meet her new life? What was she afraid of?
Did Arthur seem such a monster? It wasn't as if she were marrying an old man, 3 times her age. Arthur was young, quite ready to give her honour and respect. They slept that night in a tent pitched on a carefully chosen dry spot, listening to the winds and the rain moaning and pelting down. Igraine woke once in the night to hear Guinevere whimper. "What's the matter, child? Are you sick?"
"No. Lady, do you think Arthur will like me?"
"There is no reason he should not," Igraine said gently. "You certainly know you are beautiful."
"Am I?"
In her soft voice, it sounded only naive, not the self-conscious or coy plea for compliment or reassurance that it would have been in a lover.
"Lady Eleanor said my nose was too big, and that I had freckles like a cowherd."
"Lady Eleanor..." Igraine reminded herself to be charitable. Eleanor wasn't much older than Guinevere, and had borne 4 children in 6 years.
"I think perhaps she is a little short-sighted. You are lovely indeed. You have the most beautiful hair I have ever seen." "I don't think Arthur cares for beauty," Guinevere said. "He didn't even send to inquire if I were cross-eyed or one-legged, or had a squint or a hare-lip."
"Guinevere," said Igraine gently, "every woman is wedded for her dowry, but a high king, too, must marry as his counsellors bid him. Do you not think he is lying wakeful of nights, wondering what fortune the lottery has cast him, and that he will not greet you with gratitude and joy because you bring him beauty and good temper and learning as well? He was resigned to taking whatever he must, but he will be all the happier when he discovers that you are not, what was it, hare-lipped or pock-marked or cross-eyed?
He is young and hasn't much experience with women.
And Lancelot, I am sure, has told him that you are beautiful and virtuous." Guinevere let out her breath.
"Lancelot is Arthur's cousin, is he not?"
"True. He is son to Ban of Benwick by my sister, who is the great priestess of Avalon. He was born in the great marriage. Know you anything of that? In Les Britain, some of the people call for the old pagan rites," Igraine said. "Even Uther, when he was made High King, was taken to Dragon Island and crowned by the old rites there, though they didn't demand of him that he marry the land. In Britain that is done by the Merlin, so that he is sacrificed for the king if need be." Guinevere said,
"I didn't know these old pagan rites were still known in Britain. Was Arthur crowned so?"
"If he was," said Igraine, "he hasn't told me. Perhaps by now things have changed, and he is content that the Merlin should be only his chiefest of counsellors."
"Do you know the Merlin, lady?"
"He is my father."
"Is it so?"
Guinevere stared at her in the dark.
"Lady, is it true that when Uther Pendragon came to you before you were wedded to him, he came to you by the Merlin's arts in the magical disguise of Gorlois, so that you lay with him thinking he was Duke of Cornwall, and you still a chaste and faithful wife?"
Igraine blinked. She had heard rumours of tales that she had borne Uther's son with unseemly haste, but this story she had never heard.
"They say that." "Sometimes, lady. There are bard's tales about it."
"Well, it isn't true," said Igraine. "He wore Gorlois's cloak and bore Gorlois's ring, which he had taken when they fought. Gorlois was traitor to his high king, and his life forfeit. But whatever tales they tell, I knew perfectly well that it was Uther and no other."
Her throat closed. Even now it seemed only as if Uther was still alive somewhere, away on campaign. "You loved Uther. It was not, then, the Merlin's magic?"
"No," Igraine said.
I loved him well. Though I think at first he chose to marry me because I was of the old royal line of Avalon.